Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. We're sitting here in snowy Illinois. We got a lot of snow overnight here, probably 6 to 8 inches in east central Illinois. And Christmas is around the horn, coming on to us again. Well, tonight I talk about Christmas presents and everything for all the soldiers and all the good boys and girls involved. And what's better than a good Christmas present? I think it goes back to historically for everybody involved in the military or police or fire and all this stuff, or farmers. Everybody likes to get a new gun for Christmas. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about guns and gun safety. With me is Frank Wright. Frank Wright is Vice President of Gun Save Life, and he's an NRI instructor. NRI instructor, he's been teaching for many, many years. He's an author of a book. And let's talk about guns and gun safety. Good evening, Frank. Welcome to Warrior Connection.
Good evening, Doug. I thank you very much for your kind invitation, and I extend my best hopes for the holidays to all of your listeners.
Yeah, well, you have a bunch of children that served in the military. You had one of your sons in the famed 82nd Airborne, correct?
Yes, he was 82nd Airborne, and now he's now at the
infantry school at Fort Benning.
Yes, indeed. He's what they call a black hat there. He's training the young guys to defy gravity.
Something real nice. Well, tonight, let's talk about a little about guns. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different types of guns that a person can purchase.
Hi,
obviously,
Doug.
If you're a farmer and you like to do hunting, a shotgun is one of those choices that most everybody has. Another one is a rifle they can grab a hold of. They can get a revolver and they get a pistol. Those are kind of the different four types, aren't they, Frank?
Well, yes, indeed. Again, firearms choice depends on primarily what is available, how much you have to spend, and again, for what reason, the purpose behind the purchase of the firearm. You can't say, you know, what is best. That would be tantamount to asking what is the best kind of motor vehicle. Well, that depends on whether you're mining gold or you're trying to get the kids to the soccer game. The same sort of considerations are certainly in line with firearms choice, whether you want something for pure recreation, whether you want it for hunting purposes or self-defense purposes or anything in between. Your requirements would definitely dictate your choice. But then on the other hand, we're talking about Christmas, and any kind of gun anybody wanted to get me was absolutely wonderful.
I think everybody got their Red Ryder when they were young. I think I got my first one I was probably 6 or 7 years old.
No, you're an old-timer. I got one at about age 3 simply because I conned my mother into thinking it was a pop gun. And when she got it home, my father explained that, no, it was a BB gun. And it started off just with that and progressed rather rapidly to 22s.
Yeah, I think the first rifle I got was a 22, and I obviously got a 12-gauge shotgun because we were hunting pheasant and rabbit and ducks and all of those.
Well, like many, I started with a 22. I got my first one that was my own to maintain, to clean, and take care of, and to secure for Christmas when I was 7 years old in second grade. It was a different world. I remember I took it to school for the equivalent of show and tell, again, a different world, and the only stipulation that my teacher had was that, one, we could not load it, two, I had to give a gun safety lecture to the class, and three, I had to take it home at lunch because she did not want to be responsible for it in case someone would knock it over.
So I guess we're right to the very beginning. Gun safety is what it's all about, isn't it?
Gun safety is absolutely paramount. Everybody likes to talk about their freedoms, their rights. When we are discussing firearms ownership, and I don't care whether you accept that as a basic human right in the United States or not, if, however, you elect to exercise your right to possess a firearm, unlike the other constitutional rights, carries with it an absolute responsibility that you, as a firearms owner or the giver of a firearm to a third party, must become aware, must be basically aware of the basic firearm safety requirements. It is a right plus a very considerable responsibility.
When we look at the firearm safety rules, I mean, this I'm taking right out of the NRI handbook. That was a guide, the textbook you used when I took a course from you.
Indeed.
And it always says, number one rule, always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. What does that mean?
Absolutely. That is It is expressed many ways, but the meaning is always the same and is always very clear. This means do not point the muzzle of your firearm, whether it be shotgun, rifle, handgun, at anything that you would not see destroyed.
Well, that's pretty simple.
It is pretty simple indeed. And if, in fact, that is always followed, never violated, then no one will ever get hurt.
The next rule is always keep your finger off the trigger until ready to shoot. Well, that's all handling of the firearm, no matter what type it is, isn't it?
It is indeed, and it is a cardinal rule. Muzzle first, cotton picking finger off the cotton picking trigger, unless you are in the act of firing. I ought to kid, to make a joke with my classes, treat your firearm, handle your firearm as if there is some magic being, perhaps in Cleveland, that has a button that he can push and load and fire your gun at any time. If, in fact, you never point at anything that you won't have destroyed, and if you keep your finger off the trigger, unless you're in the act of firing, then there is no such thing as a firearms accident.
Well, the next one is always keep your firearm unloaded until ready to use. Boy, I can't think of any more cardinal rule than that.
Absolutely. And there's no need to have your hunting gun, for example, loaded and stuffed in a closet and the like. Storing guns in a loaded condition is merely asking for tragedy. I have been on several occasions in my life asked to appraise firearms collections, normally from an estate. And at least two times I can recall getting or being presented with a rather sizable firearms collection straight from the closet, and every one was loaded. This is above and beyond the call of brains. Keep those firearms unloaded until they are in use. The next question, of course, is what about self-defense firearms? Well, I suggest to you that a firearm being carried, retained, or placed for self-defense purposes is in fact in use. And any time that the firearm may be needed to be accessed for self-defense purposes, having it loaded is certainly absolutely reasonable, so long as it is absolutely safe, unavailable to unauthorized persons.
The next rule, and this is what my uncle and my dad taught me and everybody else, number one, is know your target and what is beyond.
Absolutely. We're talking about here, of course, the actual discharge, the firing of the firearm. You have to know what you're shooting at and be aware that the target may not stop a bullet. And, of course, except for you and me who never miss, the there needs to be a backstop that will absorb the round safely. Once discharged, that bullet cannot ever be called back. And in fact, you know, there really, realistically, is never such thing as a miss. Once you pull the trigger and the round is loosed, it always strikes something. Again, be sure of your target and what is behind it so that we have a safe firing. And
so you're not only looking to make sure what's behind it, but also is moving into the area. Because if you're living on a farm and you're a farmer and you're shooting or you're hunting, you got to watch out that you haven't got a car or a child or a vehicle or something that moves into your range.
That's an excellent point. And just because you have determined that your target and what's behind it is safe, that's not a static situation. You have to continue that evaluation, that monitoring, for throughout the time that you're actually engaged in shooting. One time during a class, we had about, I don't know, perhaps two or three dozen students on the line actively engaged in firing handguns. This was a handgun self-defense class. When all of a sudden, from behind the high berm, the backstop into which the bullets were impacting, we had a person appear and look down to see what all that noise was about. This was a well-disciplined class. Everyone on their own initiative began yelling ceasefire, and nothing came of it except the identification of somebody who was trying to remove himself from the gene pool.
Gets to be funny. Know how to use a gun safely. Wow. That's a lot involved, isn't it? Because it depends on each and every different type.
Absolutely. And again, that is the part of the responsibility that accompanies that Second Amendment right. First rule, if you do not know how to operate a firearm, don't touch it. Determine, ask competent authority how to make certain that the weapon is not loaded. Again, one of the old, I come from primarily a law enforcement background, and one of the old-time stories on very many police departments revolved around the Thompson submachine gun. Most of us know that in order to check a firearm, you open the action. On a semi-automatic, that means, first of all, removing the magazine, and secondly, pulling the action back, the slide back, or the bolt back, to inspect the chamber. Well, with the Thompson submachine gun,
it
fires from an open bolt. So when you go through the act of locking that bolt back to check, you've actually cocked it and made it ready to fire. And police departments in the old days were notorious for learning about this by making unusual pockmarks in the squad room.
Is knowing how to use guns safely, is there any age that's too young to start teaching? I know growing in and around a farm with my family, we were taught from the time we were out of the crib. I don't think we were even out of the crib about guns and gun safety. And you don't touch it. It's in the corner. It's part of life. It's a tool. And you just learn how to use it properly from as far back as I can remember. Isn't that the best way to do it?
Absolutely. A firearm, not unlike a internal combustion engine or a gas stove, is an inherently dangerous instrumentality. Having them in the environment requires a certain level of sophistication, a certain level of training, the formality of which can vary, of course, with the circumstances. Now, if you're going to have a gun around, one is absolutely obligated to know how to use it, how to make it safe, how not to hurt other people with it, and you, as a consumer, also have the additional requirement that you need to make certain that you don't place yourself in a position where someone can get hurt. You mentioned ages and what was an appropriate age, and I get this question frequently in classes. My standard response to how young or how old a child should be before they receive formal firearms training is a standard response. How old should a child be before they are taught not to stick their tongue in a light socket? Now, they don't need to know about electricity. They don't need to know about wiring. But they need to darn well know not to stick their tongue in the light socket. And if there's a gun in the house, they need to know that is something they do not touch. Now, their NRA has a very, very simple, I guess you could call it a catechism, for the training and indoctrination of young children. And I would suggest that you drown-proof your children with this, and tell them, if they come upon a gun, stop, don't touch it, leave the area, and tell an adult. Now, with that, they will have overcome the greatest hazards, that meaning in manipulating a dangerous device about which they know nothing, and secondly, being near that dangerous device, and thirdly, of course, you not knowing about it.
The next thing, again, is be sure your gun is safe to operate. Boy, that gets into a whole can of worms because every gun operates differently. You need to know everything about that particular weapon before you ever load it and everything else. But, boy, that's a huge, huge topic, isn't it?
Well, it dovetails very nicely in to knowing the basics about how to manipulate the weapon, how to determine its loaded or unloaded status, and how to render it operable or inoperable. And as you've noted, the design characteristics of firearms run the gamut of hand cannons that you stuck a lighted fuse into modern military weapons that fire, you know, hundreds of rounds in a second. If you're going to be around it, you have to know. Well, the military Gatling guns.
Yeah, about 4,000 rounds a minute.
Right, and that comes out to quite a few every second. It's you've already mown down a village just when you say, oh, oops. So a dangerous thing. You have to know how your firearm operates. And again, if you don't know how, you don't know, are not familiar with that mechanism, put the bravado aside. And I know it's an unmanly thing to do, but read the instruction manual. It'll all be in there.
Regular cleaning is also essential to this, isn't it?
Yes. Firearms are at once delicate mechanisms and rather robust. But the delicate aspects of them, the bore, for example, they need to be maintained on a regular basis. Now, any introductory book regarding firearms will include sections in it pertaining to the cleaning of the firearm. Again, using the gift context, if you get a new gun for Christmas, it will come with a manual. And again, like I say, it's not the manly thing to do, but nonetheless, take a few minutes in privacy of your own bedroom, if you don't want anybody seeing you stoop to this, and read the manual. It will tell you what you need to know about cleaning and maintenance.
Use the correct ammunition. Boy, how many times have both you and I run into it, both in the military and law enforcement, where somebody attempted to use the wrong ammo and the wrong gun, and it's catastrophic in nature?
Absolutely. Two questions to ask. First, does it fit? And secondly, is it right? The correct ammunition with respect to modern cartridge firearms, the caliber, the cartridge will be designated someplace stamped in the metal, usually on the barrel of that weapon. For example, 22 short, long rifle, 30-06, 30-30, that sort of thing. Again, if it's not there, or if it's not clear to you as the consumer, then ask someone, a gun dealer, a more experienced relative, but make certain that it fits and it is right. Just because a cartridge will go into a mechanism does not mean it was the one that was designed for it. I'm from just after the World War II generation, and it seemed like half of the guys brought back 8 millimeters from the European theater, or Arisakas in variety of calibers from the Pacific theater. And one of the tragedies that always seemed to be commonly reported was someone sticking an 8-millimeter Mauser into a 30-06 chamber and firing it. This, of course, results in one trying to blast a 32 caliber projectile down a 30 caliber bore. Some refer to this as a bomb.
It's not going to work.
Well,
it's going to explode.
The pressure can be monumental, and at a minimum, the gun will be wrecked. And if worst happens, then the shooter as well.
Now, we also come in today, we're getting a lot of home defense issues. And you're going to run into, with a handgun particularly, of either a revolver or a semi-auto pistol or something, the concept of plus P. What does that mean? What does that refer to?
Plus P means plus or additional pressure, and it is a shorthand for the production of self-defense ammunition or hunting ammunition that is loaded to higher pressures, delivering greater velocity and greater terminal impact than so-called standard ammunition. Now, the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute, that's a mouthful, abbreviated frequently as SAMI, publishes the load characteristics for all calibers in the United States. And the plus P ammunition is usually loaded to a 10 or 15% increase over so-called standard velocity.
That requires a gun that's rated for plus P, doesn't it? You can't take and put plus P into a weapon that's standard pressures.
Absolutely. Let us look at, for example, the 38 Special. That came into being around the turn of the last century.
1900.
Thereabouts, slightly before. And well, I say slightly, I think 1899, initially as a black powder cartridge for a very short time, and then was loaded throughout, and it is today one of the most common handgun cartridges that we will find. Well, the old revolvers from 1900, World War One era, let us say, were designed to be fired with pressures, let's say, around 15,000, 16,000 pounds per square inch. It sounds like a lot, and indeed it is. But the modern Plus P can be in the low 20,000 pounds per square inch. So if one were to fire one of these souped-up Plus P cartridges in great-grandpa's 38, it could result in damage to the gun, or heaven forbid, even to the shooter or people standing close by. And certainly it would wreck a desirable old collector's item.
And here, in any case, though, the Plus P ammo is still the same dimensions as a regular piece of ammo.
It is indeed. And the Plus P designation will normally be stamped on the, as part of the head stamp on the base of the cartridge. However, holding it in one's hand or looking at it on a shelf or looking at it on a table, they look to be the same. The dimensions are unchanged.
I think you and I both started learning about law enforcement about the same time, the early 70s, when we got out of getting in college and getting out. And obviously at that time, the police load, the Plus P, was a spear load, and that was kind of a law enforcement load at one time, kind of restricted to law enforcement. It kind of went away, didn't it, where anybody can purchase it?
Yes, the concept of law enforcement only ammunition, which was stamped on the box, the only effect that had to the general public was to make them want law enforcement only ammunition. And this being a market-driven nation, the manufacturers made that available to anyone who wanted it very quickly. And in addition, hand loading or reloading the manufacturer of your own ammunition from basic components allows the careful hand loader to tailor a chambering to anything that they need, from wax bullets that can be fired, you know, at a few feet in a garage or basement, to higher power for target shooting, or maximum power for self-defense or hunting.
Well, the next thing, and again, kind of common sense, and both of us have the effects from being around this too many years in our special...
I know what you're going to say.
Is we have to wear eye protection, we have to have hearing protection, correct?
Absolutely. To do without that in this time, knowing what we do know today, is just proving to the world how less than intelligent one might be. Hearing protection, eye protection need to be in use anytime you're around a firearm. Now, I said around a firearm, not just firing. If you're close enough to hear it as a loud noise, hearing protection and eye protection. I have significant hearing loss because of an incident in which I had a .357 fired very close to my left ear, or six rounds, and I haven't been able to listen to classical music critically for almost 25 years now.
Occupational hazard.
Well, occupational hazard and someone inattentive got me. But hearing protection need not be, you know, a $400 set of earmuffs. One can get good protection from the closed cell foam earplugs that are available at any drugstore.
Eye protection is not just your simple eyeglasses, is it?
Well, they are better than nothing. And with the modern eyeglasses, none of them available in the United States will shatter anymore. They are relatively shatterproof. However, I would suggest that if you're buying eyeglasses for use around firearms, that they contain safety lenses. And again, clear eye protection is available at any sporting goods store today.
Never use alcohol or drugs. Oh my, what else can be said?
Well, alcohol and drugs and gunpowder don't mix. First of all, they don't shoot well. And secondly, you're just absolutely courting disaster, legally, morally, and just from a common sense standpoint. I don't care. I am not a drinker, but many of my friends are. Many of my shooting buddies are. But it is an ironclad, inviolate rule that there will be no alcohol consumed as long as the guns are out. Simple.
And that comes back to the same time, the same stuff is how long does it take alcohol to be read out of your system? So you can't be drinking and then decide to go shooting, can you?
Absolutely cannot. I tell my students, and particularly those who are concealed carry candidates, treat yourself like an airline pilot. If you have alcohol in the bloodstream, whether you are consider yourself drunk or not, and I might say the drunk is the last person to ever ask if he is drunk. But again, if there is alcohol in the system, stay away from the guns. It makes the legal, the justification for use of deadly force, for example, an almost impossible hurdle.
Storing guns. What can we say about storage of guns? I mean, you have to have your purpose. I mean, again, the farmer's out there on the farm. He's probably got it on the tractor. He's got it out in the shed. It's there very specifically like a hammer or a shovel.
Indeed.
You have self-defense firearms. If you're law enforcement, obviously you're going to have them with you all the time. If you're in the home defense and leaving a situation, you have to consider, how do I store my gun but still readily have it accessible? So what comes in tails in storage of guns and accessibility?
The cardinal rule about firearm storage is to store your weapons, your firearms, whether you consider them weapons or not, store the firearm so that it is not accessible to unauthorized persons. Now, we're not necessarily meaning just children, but certainly they're not authorized. But it could be that weird Uncle Ed or your crazy grandpa, whatever, the unauthorized person. In other words, that is someone who should not be, in your estimation, in possession. Because if they access your firearm and misuse it, well, I suggest you can see the legal bag of worms that are open with that. Now, the self-defense weapon can be loaded and can be readily accessible, but that means that you are in control of it and you are in the control of the space in which it is stored. If it's in the bedside stand, for example, or a shotgun in the corner, that's fine. That's perfectly legitimate to have that as a readily accessible self-defense weapon. But the next day, when the grandkids or the little kids or the kid down the block is in your home, a different set of rules apply. They have to be stored so that they are not accessible to unauthorized persons. That may mean locking them up. It certainly means unloading them. It can be, one can use a firearm safe. One can use the traditional gun case in a closet. But today, we also have available a great variety of trigger locks, which are quick and easy mechanisms to disable a firearm from the unauthorized person.
There's a whole bunch of different types of guns and different activities that can be done, isn't there? And you have to match all of this stuff together. So whether we're out there with our Red Ryder, mm-hmm. and Ralphie has got it, don't shoot out your eye, or you're out there and you're having a lot of fun on a range where you have everything totally controlled, or you're shooting tin cans in your backyard, all the different things, or you're going pheasant hunting, rabbit hunting, whatever you're going after, all this stuff is different, and all the activities have different rules, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And again, common sense and legality will prevail. You mentioned tin cans in the backyard. Well, we differ considerably on our respective backyards. I live in a suburban area, and you live out here in God's land, where you can shoot almost promiscuously and indiscriminately in any direction, safely. But I don't enjoy that. Absolutely. You have to use common sense and all the rules that we just talked about, knowing the target, what's beyond, muzzle control, cotton picking finger off the trigger, all those come to play to avoid tragedy.
Well, let's talk about different types of gun. First thing everybody thinks about is a rifle. What is a rifle and what does it consist of and what different types are there?
Well, we're talking about a rifle, and as a matter of definition, for the last 500 years or so, a rifle refers to a firearm, and it's a long gun as opposed to a sidearm or a handgun, in which the bore, the area through which the projectile is blown, contains rifling to impart a spiral to the projectile. This results in greater range and a great deal of increase in precision with which that shot may be placed.
So you've got different rifles. You can have a bolt-action rifle. You can have a lever-action rifle. You could have a top break, which is just a single-shot type of rifle.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a slide action. There's a whole bunch of different types of rifles. Does anyone, are these all very specific purposes, or is this something an individual choice on what you're going to use and be trained on?
Well, Doug, largely that is a matter of individual choice. With some influence certainly made by the purpose to which the rifle, the firearm is to be placed. For plinking purposes, and I define that as just recreational shooting safely at our targets of opportunity, the proverbial tin can or clay pigeon or whatever, not at bottles, please. That sort of recreational shooting can be enjoyed with any safe firearm type. Similarly, with hunting, we have hunters who prefer any given sort. The most common sort is the bolt-action rifle, but we have hunters who are single-shot advocates. We have hunters who use the pump action, slide action, also called a trombone action, and we have increasingly commonly the semi-automatic. Many hunters, especially big game hunters, were introduced to firearms, more so today even than in the past, by their exposure in the service. And it's an M16 world, a semi-automatic world. So the training that they received as young recruits may, in fact, carry over to their preferences as adult deer hunters. And many of them will prefer nowadays a semi-automatic.
Well, we've got World War I, obviously, and everything, the historic Op-3. Okay, Springfield Op-3. That was World War I. Again, it's based on a Mauser action. That was a bolt-action rifle. We get to World War II, and a lot of collectors, World War II veterans, they have the legendary Garand, don't they?
Indeed they do. America's first semi-automatic.
And so those are seen all over the place. We get to Vietnam in our era. Obviously, we were introduced, we had the M14 and then onto the M16 or an AR-15, similar nomenclatures, but substantially different weapons, aren't they?
Well, they are. If we're comparing the M16 to the 1903, for example, the 1903, you said it was based on a Mauser. Indeed, it was based so closely on a Mauser that the United States was paying royalty fees to Germany right up until the declaration of World War I, which changed matters. But yes, it's called a turnbolt, very, very safe, very powerful, can be a weapon. The rate of fire is limited by the dexterity, if you will, of the shooter, and the fact that normally they have a maximum of about a 5-round magazine. The Garand, which Patton described, I believe, as the epitome of weapons, had an 8-round in-block clip, which also shared the .30-06 caliber with the 1903, and, of course, could be fired 8 times in a row and ejected the clip out the top. We also adopted, during World War II, the 30 Garand, excuse me, the 30 carbine, which was a 15 or 30 shot, almost like a pistol round, and less powerful, but it was our first, you might call it, assault rifle in the United States. And then later, in the late 50s, we adopted the Stoner design, which became the M16, and all of its huge variations. It is America's rifle at this point.
Yeah, the M16. So, I mean, again, dealing with the M16, a very accurate, very rifle, easy to use, simple to maintain. But at the same time, we got the comparison of the M16 and the Soviet AK-47, don't we? So those are historically the two weapons of the current generation.
Yes, and if one wants to start a really nice fight among firearms aficionados, you can get into the discussion of which is better, the M16 platform or the Kalashnikov platform. And that brings up the old dispute of Ford versus Chevy.
Which is not useful. Again, everybody has a specific purpose design, and you have to select the gun based on your own specific need and how well it fits you, don't you?
And yes, and let us also not overlook the impact of bias and bullheadedness.
All that comes into place. Well, the next thing we have, obviously, is a revolver. And what is a revolver?
Well, as the name might suggest, Revolver is a handgun. Well, there have been some long guns, but primarily it is a handgun that has a cylinder containing traditionally six rounds that revolves as the mechanism is operated to bring the next round to be fired in line with the barrel. It revolves behind it, and hence the name of it. Now, I say traditionally six rounds. Today we have commonly revolvers that hold from five rounds to 10 for some of the 22 and the small calibers.
Yeah, so we have a revolver or a wheel gun. Now, the historic gun of all time, probably the legendary 1911.
The 1911, of course, is the darling of the pistol self-defense competition crowd, and it isn't used to the exclusion of all others, but someone shows up on the line as a serious competitor without a 1911 platform, they are the subject of some scrutiny as to see what they have. It is the standard by which all semi-automatic handguns are judged.
What does semi-automatic mean? Semi-automatic mean?
Well, semi-automatic as opposed to automatic or fully automatic. Fully automatic, think in terms of machine pistols or machine guns. One pull of the trigger will result in multiple discharges until the magazine is empty. Semi-automatic requires that the trigger be released and re-engaged for each shot. It loads itself. Semi-automatics can also are referred to as self-loaders.
Now, an automatic weapon, these machine guns, everything, these have been outlawed without special approval and tax stamps and everything since the 1930s, correct? So the average citizen can't get one unless they go through an extensive background check and they maintain everything according to law, correct?
Yes, we're making reference to the National Firearms Act of, as I recall, 1934, the height, as you won't remember personally, but historically of the gangster era. At that time, before that time, anyone could mail order a Thompson if you could afford it. They were quite expensive. Or anything else. You could actually order a Browning or a Maxim belt-fed machine gun up until 1934. Again, that's why that was such a high crime time compared with today. Ha. And that was a joke.
Yeah. So we've got all the different types. Now, the other thing we have is a shotgun, and I know you favor a shotgun, don't you?
I favor a shotgun for home defense. A shotgun is the most telling, the most effective self-defense handgun that firearm that can be brought to bear. Anything more effective is not fired from the shoulder, but usually with a lanyard.
And a lanyard refers to something like a cannon.
Indeed.
What type of training is necessary to go through this? I mean, you've been teaching for a long, long time, both in law enforcement and the civilian world. What type of training is out there in the world for all the soldiers, everybody coming back? Because you've been over in a war, current time, all the Vietnam vets, you guys went Desert Storm, and the current ones, hey, this is neat. I have this. I want to get this, and I come back, and I want to do it. But now we have to have training. They want to see a pistol. They want to get one. They want to get a revolver. What training is out there, and how do they get the training? What does it consist of?
Well, we have a great luxury today of availability on almost all levels of training. Also, and I'll bring it up immediately, there is the concept of self-training, and I don't want to poo-poo that in the slightest, because if you as a firearms owner, newly acquired, if you want to read about it, there are many, many texts published that with regard to safety. It's just think in terms of golf, you know, but plus a safety factor. If you want to learn how to play golf, you can read about it, but it certainly helps to have some hands-on training from someone in the know. And today, we have a variety of schools available in all states for formal target shooting, for self-defense shooting, hunting, and anything in between.
And it's essential that a person gets enrolled in one of these classes, isn't it?
Well, I'm biased because I teach them. Yes, I believe it is the quickest, safest, most direct route to firearms, I don't want to call it perfection, but safety and proficiency.
I know. Through my career and all the years in the military, I've been through this many, many times, and I did participate and sit into your class that you did teach, which was a basic home personal use home protection course, mm-hmm. which took us several days, which was really, really excellent. And this covers a whole bunch of different things, doesn't it? What's involved in an average class or average course like that?
Well, that's easy. Safety, safety, safety. Most classes, and I'm talking about less than the master's class, most classes will teach the students from the assumption that they don't know which end of the gun is dangerous. By the end of the second day, they're normally getting into the expert class, if not in terms of firearms manipulation, certainly they're experts in firearm safety by that time and fully qualified to train the kids and the neighbors and that crazy Uncle Ed. Again, all of our classes, and I speak not just for ours, but any course, safety, legality relating to the choice, storage, manipulation, the use of the firearms, and then the hands-on proficiency skills, the physical skills required to be able to use a firearm effectively and safely. I say, in terms of training, for your listeners, whether they are gun owners or not, they have all received extensive firearms training, unless they're, a religious sect that doesn't have electricity, because they have seen the use of firearms on television and in the movies since childhood. Everybody knows, the quick draw, be it military or cowboy or cops and robbers. Everybody knows all about this, and usually it's terribly wrong. If you want to see how not to use a firearm, go look at some of the old Davy Crockett movies. I was recently aghast and amused by a Hopalong Cassidy series. William Boyd, one of my childhood heroes, a Western star from the pre-World War I era up until the 1950s.
And he dressed all in black.
He dressed all in black, and his horse was named Topper, for you addicts out there. But the gun handling, which means the script writing, was atrocious. It seemed that every episode, old Hopalong, Hoppy, shot the gun out of somebody's hand. I saw it twice in the episode that I recently watched. And in both times, the bad guy was holding the gun in front of his body. There's no way of getting that 45 slug into that pistol without bouncing it on into the guy's abdomen. It's just amazing, the craziness. And they have their finger on the trigger, and they're pointing at each other all the time. So folks, do not rely on Hollywood training for survival in a handgun situation.
Now, we have, obviously, if you're going to go hunting, there's different departments of conservation for each state and each area have very specific hunting courses for the young kids and up to adults, don't they?
Most states have available some sort of hunter safety course. Increasingly, the hunter safety course is a requirement to get a hunting license. It is in Illinois, for example, and has been for a couple of decades now. It's not required in all states, but it's a good idea, certainly, in all states.
Now, let's get into one area, and I know this is especially, you've written a book about this and everything else, and this is personal protection and everything. What is involved in that, just briefly? I mean, we could go on for 8 or 10 hours on that easily and not even touch the subject, but could you basically describe the concept of self-protection and what's involved in that, and what do we have to look for, and what do we need to do or think about?
Well, self-defense with a firearm carries with it a huge, ladies and gentlemen, responsibility to acquire the requisite skills and legal knowledge to be able to use the firearm safely, store it safely, and know when or when you may or may not use it in a self-defense mode. This is something that is not intuitive. It is something for which Hollywood is responsible for a lot of terrible, terrible training. You know, shoot it, the gun out of his hand, shoot the wound, and he's, you know, back in the next episode next week with not even a limp. A huge responsibility. Firearms choice and selection. Doug, what would you like to address first?
Well, that's how we select a gun for self-protection.
All right. Again, a firearm for self-protection depends on where you're defending yourself and against what you're defending yourself. If you're berry picking on Kodiak Island, then your adversary is likely to be a grizzly bear or a brown bear, as we call them, a different variety of the same species. If, however, you are on the in Chicago or any of the northeastern cities, your adversary is likely not to be a grizzly bear. Let's put it that way. What is adequate for one is not for the other. In terms of, we also must say, ask the question, where are you going to be defending yourself? At home or on the street? At home, my universal suggestion as the best choice is some sort of repeating shotgun. They are the most effective in terms of power that can be fired from the shoulder. They're difficult to point at yourself. They are terribly intimidating. Most bad guys, burglars, home invaders, when looking down the barrel of a shotgun, suddenly remember important engagements that they have elsewhere. Now, outside the home, that is the bailiwick, if you will, the area in which the handgun rules supreme because of its portability and its concealability.
What concealability mean?
Concealability means the ability to have the firearm on your person, carried in such a manner that it is readily accessible, readily available to you to bring into play for self-defense, and yet is not viewable, is not apparent to the casual observer.
Well, the concealed carry in self-defense requires extensive training almost in every state, requires all kinds of things that you have to think about, what you need to do before you even think about this, doesn't it?
Well, the self-defense training requirements vary from virtually nothing to, well, Illinois, for example, it's a 16-hour course requirement with firing. In a few states, for example, Vermont, a known high crime area, and Alaska, an even higher crime area, the training requirements are the same that you have to be a parent or to vote. But I think the firearm owner is selling themselves short if they do not avail themselves of some formal training.
When you look at the use of a firearm in self-defense, what is the basic principle? I mean, you have to be in direct fear of your life. The individual has to go through this.
Well, I will give you the law relating to the use of deadly force, or the justifiable use of deadly force, in one long sentence, and it skirts any legal technicalities and cuts right to the moral and legal center of the issue, and that is deadly force, which is defined as that degree of force which is likely to cause death or great bodily harm, is justified only when it is reasonably necessary and otherwise unavoidably necessary to avoid the imminent, immediate, right here, right now, infliction of death or great bodily harm upon the innocent. And hopefully you, as the law-abiding firearm owner, are included in the innocent.
Pretty important, isn't it?
It is indeed.
And
it's
this
critical.
Is a reason why going through all the extensive training, both classroom portions and the field portions, are critical, aren't they?
They are indeed critical. And commensurate with the basic skills, both physical and mental, is the requirement of a requisite mindset. And I'm going to talk about from the self-defense standpoint primarily. You can't carry a gun or use a gun to scare people. If you have not made the decision, and this is a heavy, heavy subject, if you have not made the decision that you could take a human life in defense of yourself or another innocent person, then do not resort to firearms as part of your self-defense regimen. Very simple. That mindset is absolutely critical.
Now, this mindset for all of those people who have just come back to combat, whether you were in Vietnam or there's still the World War II or Korea or Desert Storm, or they're coming back now from Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and all of this New Dawn, that soldier has a different mindset from when he was in war, in wartime environment, to what he's going to encounter in the civilian world, doesn't he?
It is absolutely a different planet, as you bring out. The law, however, is basically the same. It is a reasonable person standard, and I ask, what would a reasonable and prudent individual do in your circumstances as the firearm wielder with the knowledge that you had and the circumstances that you faced at the time you had to decide to shoot or not shoot? This applies to the 18-year-old with a firearm, to the World War II vet with a firearm, and anyone in between. The law, the legal analysis remains the same. What would a reasonable person have done? And then that long sentence that I gave you before.
Pretty important.
Critical.
Well, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can obviously go if you're going to go out and buy a gun. I mean, one thing that I learned a long time ago, and you've taught in your course, and you've emphasized to everybody I know, is the fact that if you're going to go out and buy a gun, what's essential for you to do is go to a club, go to specific training, and try out a whole bunch of different ones, isn't it?
It is absolutely the case. I went through this recently with my baby sister. She lives in Missouri and is a concealed carry permit holder and was buying her first personal defense dedicated handgun. My suggestion to her and my suggestion to all of you is read up on the subject, go to a large emporium or multiple ones, gun shows, large sporting good dealers, handle as many firearms as you can. Don't listen to the salesman's hype. Don't buy something that doesn't feel good in the hand and that you cannot operate. And then my suggestion to her and to you is that she shoot as many of her final choices as possible to find the one that feels good, that feels intuitive, and is simple to operate. She ended up getting a semi-automatic 9mm that is a common issue to police officers, and it is perfect. She's had it for about 3 months now and has put about 1,000 rounds through it.
That's pretty good.
Indeed.
So no matter what type of weapon you buy, the essential thing is getting training and then practice under competent instruction or at least common sense.
Absolutely. Having a firearm without the requisite physical skills is asking for disaster. The mere possession of a gun, be it long or short, does not make you any more safe than the possession of a Stradivarius makes you an accomplished violinist. Instrumentalities is not the same as prowess with the instrumentalities.
There's been throughout history a lot of people in their mindset and everything that buy a certain gun or saying, well, I'm going to buy the best there is, and automatically all of a sudden that'll make me the best there is. That has nothing to do with it. It's whether the weapon gun fits your hand, fits your body, whether or not you practice it, you've got trained, you know how to operate it. So you could buy a reasonably good, cheap, well-made gun that's going to function as well as a $3,000 gun rifle, couldn't you?
Will function, absolutely. And again, we can bring up the comparison with golfers. They seem to share the same defect of the mind, I say that jokingly, as we firearms aficionados do. And certainly you can play and enjoy golf with a used set that you get from a used equipment store. However, the successful professional is not going to do that. And similarly, the firearms professional is going to have a gun, you know, tailor-made or altered to fit their specific requirements and circumstances. That doesn't mean that you can't go across the counter and buy a perfectly adequate firearm to learn with and to enjoy with. I have been shooting for over 50 years now, and I own only a couple of custom guns. Most of mine are ready to wear, so to speak, over the counter.
Yeah, speaking about ready to wear over the counter and everything, we just recently had, you were involved in the class at our Gun Save Life meeting this last Tuesday night, where they talked about holsters and ready to wear and what. There's a whole, it's a whole big, another ball of wax, isn't it?
Absolutely. Again, we always make the suggestion that don't go out and spend, you know, $500 or $800 or $1,000 on your the gun of handgun of your dreams, and then stick it in a $5 gun show special holster. My suggestion to many people when they're trying to decide or conceal carry, particularly, what should they buy? Be guided by what detectives are likely to carry. Now, I say this because they're professionals. They have access to, ultimately, over a career, any kind of holster that they want. And they gravitate, for the most part, towards those that are most likely to keep them alive. That decision is well made.
Well, Frank, thank you very much. And it's been a very fast 1 hour.
Indeed it has,
sir. And everything else. And is there any last things you'd like to say?
Well, my last thing is remember muzzle, safe direction, cotton-picking finger off the cotton-picking trigger, and have a very merry and blessed Christmas.
Thank you very much, Frank. Ladies and gentlemen, have a merry Christmas, and go to your local sporting goods store. Get a class. Enjoy the sport all the way around. Thank you very much, and good night.